Vegas, baby, Vegas!
At the end of the game, you count up your money. That's how you find out who's best.
If all my bets were safe, there just wouldn't be any juice.
The point spreads, the prop bets, the teasers, the parlays. From Vegas to you, this is Behind the Bets.
Welcome back to another episode of Behind the Bets with Doug Kazarian, presented by DraftKings, America's top-rated sportsbook app. So the machine is rolling along here. We are in November, Halloween behind us, NBA and NHL behind us, baseball behind us. So it is all football, but we do have some UFC coming up. Very abbreviated segment with Matthew and Lou. Just the main event, co-main, and one other fight on the card. We're just kind of sticking to the plays, and it depends on the week, depending what everyone likes. And then we also have going to talk a lot of college football. Pac-12 gets underway. So does the MAC tonight with six games. We'll touch on it at the end. We don't really love anything. But Matt Eumanns is the guest for college football this week. I know a lot of you have had some very positive feedback. Matt's wonderful. I've known him for 10, 15 years or whatever it's been. So he and I go way back, and he's always got great insight and does his homework. So Matt Eumanns of Vegas Stats and Information Network coming up, and then Matthew Liu will be back in with the UFC. But before we get into today's episode, I want to remind everyone that if you play fantasy football, I have a podcast you won't want to miss. Make sure you're staying up to date on all your fantasy football news with ESPN fantasy experts Matthew Berry, Field Yates, Stefania Bell, Mike Clay, and Daniel Dopp on ESPN's Fantasy Focus Football Podcast. You'll get daily strategy, previews, and injury reports to ensure you have all the information you'll need for your fantasy football team. Be sure to download and subscribe to Fantasy Focus Football and Behind the Bets on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop. Hammer time.
Got a lot of positive feedback, and no surprise, Matt Eumanns is a regular guest here, but big fans out there in the Twitterverse, Matt, so had to get you back on for the start of the Pac-12 season. And we got some action tonight. I couldn't believe it's six-game slate. I'm so excited, but I diverse. Let's get look ahead to the weekend, my friend. And this is an interesting game because Boise State had its quarterback scratched last week. Some people I know were on the under, and then first play, bomb. Boise State rolls again, but now BYU's in town. 3-point road fade for the Cougs. And I love this Cougars team, but Boise State's obviously solid on the Smurf turf.
Very interesting game to handicap here because Circus Sports opened Boise -2. I thought this game would open a pick. And early betting action obviously flipped the favorite, and it was 2.5 Sunday night. And, you know, eventually it moved to 3, which was no surprise once it got to 2.5. I think it's a little surprising to me that the early money flipped it that way because I thought the betting public would flip BYU to a favorite. And, you know, I really thought you watch BYU, all these games have been televised. Zach Wilson's put up great numbers, 74.6% completions, 19 TDs, 2 picks. He's a Heisman Trophy dark horse. You know, if there is one, if there's a sleeper this year, I think he's probably it. But Boise's got to win this, or BYU's got to win this game of Boise. Cougars are 7-0. Here's the thing, Doug. Their schedule, the Cougars' schedule has been mostly cupcakes. They've won by an average of 31 points, 6 double-digit wins. The least impressive performance, 27-20 victory over Texas San Antonio. The Roadrunners are not very good. I thought that was kind of a discouraging performance by BYU. But, hey, every team's got one of those, so just draw a line.
It was a sleepy game. They were up the whole way. Right. They were just kind of like in a funk. You know, a funk's probably the best way to put it.
The most impressive win was a week later, 43-26 at Houston. But, again, that's a poorly coached Houston Cougars team. And I don't put a lot into that because I don't respect Houston all that much. Dana Holgorsen is a joke.
Weren't they trailing in the fourth quarter? So the score is a little misleading.
The score was misleading. For anyone who bet Houston that night, that was a little bit tough to take that, but that's the way it goes. As you know, in college football, Doug, the right side doesn't always get to the window. Boise State, 91 total points against Utah State and Air Force. First two games out of the gate. I think Utah State is a trash team this year, so that game really doesn't matter. Hank Bachmeier was down last week, as you mentioned, undisclosed reasons. Jack Sears, grad transfer from USC, comes in, 17-20, 280 yards, 3 TDs. I think Sears is only a minor drop-off from Bachmeier, so it really doesn't bother me, you know, which quarterback is getting the snaps here. Or, you know, it's not going to make much of a difference for me. Boise's defense does have to adjust a little bit. You had to defend a triple option last week, and this week it's a wide open passing attack. But I don't think that's going to be a big problem for Brian Harsin. Here's the reason why I'm going to take Boise plus three. Broncos have not been underdogs on the blue turf since 2018, when they were plus two in a 24-17 victory over Fresno. I remember that game well. That's the only time, previous to this, in the past 15 years, Boise's been a home dog. This doesn't happen. BYU beat Boise 28-25 last year in Provo. I think this is going to be another tight game down to the wire. I'll actually pick Boise to win straight up by three. I think it's a big step up in class for BYU. And, after you play six cupcakes in your first seven games, then you have to go on the road and play Boise. I don't think BYU should be a field goal favorite. I'm taking the home dog plus three.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I've just had like a man crush on Wilson and this BYU offense. But the problem is, full disclosure, I just haven't watched Boise State enough. Like that's the problem, is I've watched a lot of BYU. I've watched a lot of other games, other teams in the conference, but I just haven't watched a lot of Boise. But I'll take your word for it. I'm curious your thoughts on the previous game, because I love this San Diego State team, and I love, it starts with their defense and the offense, the rushing attack. I mean, they have essentially a three-headed monster at running back, but that's only because they run the ball so much. But man, they got some weapons, and I know the totals are on the low side, but this one's on a little bit on the higher by their standards, 47.5. But how good is San Jose State? Like, don't the Aztecs just roll here?
San Jose State's actually, with Starkle quarterback, they've got a better passing offense, huh?
I know their QB's more competent. Like, last week I was on at San Diego State. Like, I just, especially second half, they, like you said, Utah State's kind of bad. But I kind of want to lay the points again.
Well, if I bet it, I would probably play San Diego State, just because of the way they run the ball and defend. I think they're more reliable, than San Jose State on the road. But I did not bet that game because the number is just a little bit too high for me to lay those points with the Aztecs at 9.5. I watched San Jose last week against a really well-coached New Mexico defense. Rocky Long coaches that defense now. San Jose hit a bunch of big pass plays down the field. And last week when San Diego State played Utah State, I don't know if you saw this, Gary Anderson, the coach of Utah State, it was a 31-7 game midway through or late in the fourth quarter. And he punted down 31-7 from the San Diego State 36-yard line. This Utah State team's got nothing. The coach knows it. And that's why I'm not that influenced by what the Aztecs did last week against Utah State, or what they did the previous week against UNLV. Marcus Arroyo, the new UNLV coach, he's not that bright. He went for two with 2 minutes to go in the first half last week against Nevada for no apparent reason. And this UNLV defense is horrendous. I saw it again last week against the Wolfpack. So I don't think you can take too much away from what you've seen in San Diego State's first two games, because they played really bad teams in the Mountain West. And that's why 9.5 is just a little bit too much for me to lay in that game.
Yeah, it's fair. By the way, end of the first half last week with San Diego State was just an incredible – I mean, it's terrible defense, but, like, incredible catch. Anyways, go check it out. It was Stanford Steve had it on their best bad beats. It was good stuff. Okay, so let's go to Saturday's card. Very interesting handicaps. We have the Pac-12 starting. I do want to start with Michigan, Indiana, though. You obviously love betting the Big Ten, and for good reason. You're locked in many times. I agree with you that it sounds like we both think there's a bet on play on Michigan, the spot here.
Yeah, I was wrong about Penn State last week. James Franklin, do you really have to go for two when it's 31-19 with 14.5 minutes to go? Does James Franklin have to do something foolish every week? I don't get that guy at all. I guess it's my fault for backing coaches that make boneheaded moves like that. Sometimes you just have to blame yourself and say, why did I bet on James Franklin again this week? Michigan, I'm going to play Michigan here, -3 over Indiana. Circa opened this at 2. There was no doubt in my mind it was going to go up to 3, 3.5, 4. You're going to want to back Jim Harbaugh, I think, in a bounce-back spot off an embarrassing home loss to Michigan State. Here's the deal with the Wolverines. Michigan State and Ohio State have had Michigan's number in Ann Arbor ever since Harbaugh got back. It's amazing. He cannot beat those teams at home. It's very discouraging what happened last week. And when you look at week one, you can say, wow, maybe this Minnesota team is really bad. And it's not that, you know, Michigan was great in week one in Minneapolis. It's just that the Gophers are really bad. It's probably a combination of the two. But for me, what this comes down to is something I talked about last week, Doug, when you and I were talking, I think, just about some games. Indiana had 211 total yards against Penn State, and 100 of those yards came on the last drive of regulation and overtime. And then you go on the road to beat a Rutgers team that benefited from 7 turnovers the previous week at Michigan State. Greg Schiano's done a great job so far, but he's got a long, long way to go to upgrade the talent on that team. Look at Rutgers' recent recruiting classes. Look at Michigan's recruiting classes. The talent gap between Michigan and Indiana in this game is going to be significant. Michael Penix, the quarterback for the Hoosiers, not that accurate of passer. That's one thing I don't like about him. His passing accuracy really lacking. I like the fact that the Harbaugh is going to he's going to coach his guys up hard this week off that embarrassing loss. And the thing that tops it off for me is that Michigan has a 24-game winning streak in this series dating back to 1987. The last time Indiana beat Michigan, Doug, you were probably in junior high. So I'm going to lay the 3 here with Harbaugh off a bad loss in a game where I think the road favorites got a significant talent edge.
Yeah, I mean, I love what Tom Young's done with the program, turning things around. Some of the series history, you know, when you talk about two programs and their track records, can be a little misleading. But Indiana's kind of like, they kind of are who we thought they were, right? They're like a middling Big Ten program. Michigan is just not elite. They get crushed by AP top 5 teams in the Harbaugh era. But they do handle the middle of the pack sort of ranked teams, fringe ranked teams. Yeah, they like bowling them. And 3 feels cheap. Now, the problem is, you know, Sparty exposed them a little bit throwing downfield. And actually, the broadcasters, you don't really get this sort of analysis early and this sort of description. But the broadcaster, I forget who was calling me. I think it was a Big Ten Network game, if not as Fox Sports. And maybe it was Joel said this, but it was like, if they're going to call this tight like they are, then Michigan's in for a long game. Because it was long passes down the sideline outside of the hashes, and they were calling PI because Michigan defense is very physical. So right away, you'll know if you're going to win or better. but my inclination is they're going to let Michigan play that way, right? That's the old NFL of the Patriots. They can't call PI on every play. Well, Michigan State, they did, but here they probably won't. So the Wolverines will be allowed to play physical on the outside, and therefore, you know, Penix is going to be limited with all the, like you said, his inaccurate nature and some of the rushing attack. Michigan will have their front 7 be able to handle it.
Yeah, I think it sets up pretty good. You know, if Michigan had won last week, I wouldn't be as crazy about this play. But off a loss and having some other problems exposed, they could work on that stuff this week, try to fix some of the stuff that went wrong last week against the Spartans. And, you know, Tom Allen has done a really good job. I like the trajectory of the Indiana program, but a lot of times people get too excited about a team and want to hype up a team that hasn't been hyped up in a long time. Early in a season, they pick up a couple of wins and everybody's eager. Hey, this is a new kid on the block. Let's hype up Indiana. They're ranked. I've watched Indiana's first 2 games. This is not a top 15 team. I don't even think it's a top 25 team. And I think reality is going to smack the Hoosiers in the face. I don't know. May not happen this week. Maybe Harbaugh's got a team that's just not that good. If that's the case, and I'll be wrong, so be it. We can't be right about every game. But
right.
I think Indiana's being a little bit overhyped by a lot of people. You got to really look closely at those first 2 games to see the truth.
You know, it's a great point about the gradual nature of turning programs around. It doesn't happen overnight. I mean, look at Northwestern, right? Like, it's taken time to move things in the right direction. And I'm trying to think of other programs that it just doesn't happen overnight. You don't just become like a top contender. You're going to have some bumps along the way, but you got to have those breakthrough moments. Penn State was one of them, but you're not going to have them all throughout. You got to learn how to win, so to speak, and do it consistently is tough. So I do like that Michigan spot as well. Let's go to the SEC. Same similar point spread of 3. Neutral site game, Georgia and Florida. And this Bulldogs quarterback play is just atrocious. I mean, let's think. I mean, just really. Like, they can't even score enough when the other opponent has 3 to cover, like a short double-digit line. It just – it's worrisome. And so, for me, you have to take the Gators here just because they have enough speed, I think, to move the ball on the Bulldogs.
They have a big quarterback edge, like you said. And that's one of the reasons I like Florida in this game. Kyle Trask against Stetson Bennett. I wouldn't be surprised at some point here if we see a quarterback switch for Georgia, because JT Daniels is waiting. And if Bennett's not getting the job done, I think pretty soon we're going to see Daniels. Kyle Trask is far superior at that position to what Georgia's got right now. And Kyle Pitts is a tight end. You're going to see him play in the NFL. This has been a series recently dominated by the Bulldogs, but I think the Gators bounce back. I like the Gators to win this game straight up. You can still get plus 3.5 out there. I see a few books right now still with 3.5. I'm not surprised this number's coming down, because I made the number Georgia 2. So when it initially opened higher than 3.5, I thought that was a steal at that point. We'll see how it turns out. But I like Dan Mullen and Kyle Trask in this matchup. Take a little bit on the, maybe take 70% of your bet on the plus 3.5 and put 30% on the money line. But I think Florida is going to win this game. And Stetson Bennett's really started to struggle, which is not a surprise. I think the last time I talked to you on this podcast or talk about so many games each week, I can't recall, but I said, Stetson Bennett, yeah, very impressive the first couple games between the hedges. Wait until this kid gets out and starts on the road at Tuscaloosa this week. Wait until he has to face some better defenses away from home, then you're going to really find out who he is. And, he's been a decent quarterback so far. It's been a pretty good story. But Kyle Trask is a far superior quarterback, and I think Florida is going to win this one.
I agree. And I think Bennett's been pretty uninspiring. My only thing is I'm not sure JT Daniels is better. I was pretty disappointed with him as a USC fan when he first burst onto the scene. So I'm not.
No,
sure
I don't like Doug. Just to be clear, I'm not a JT Daniels fan. When he was at USC, I was looking to bet against he and Clay Helton. But
I
do think that doesn't mean that Kirby Smart's not going to make the switch. I mean, Kirby Smart was not smart enough to play Justin Fields more when he had him in the program and tried that idiotic fake punt. That was what Justin Fields' time at Georgia is most remembered for, the dumb fake punt that Kirby Smart tried and failed. I think that he's probably going to switch at some point if it's not working for Stetson Bennett. It's just to see if JT Daniels can spark the offense a little bit. I'm not saying Daniels is going to be work miracles when he comes in, but I wouldn't be surprised if that switch is made pretty soon.
What do you make of Kirby Smart? I mean, we know about the boneheaded fake punt in the SEC championship game a couple of years ago. Look, coaching's not easy. I know when you're a coordinator forever, and there's obviously pressure at his alma mater and all that. But I've been, I don't know, a little disappointed with Georgia. Just the bar is set high with Kirby, and obviously he knows what he's doing on the defensive side of the ball. But there's just been some questionable games and game execution.
Of course, because when you're a first-time head coach, you're going to be learning on the job. And what I say about that is if you're learning on the job, that means you're making mistakes on the job. And a lot of times these guys aren't ready for the position. Kirby Smart's a phenomenal defensive coordinator. He's ready to run a program, but he's not ready to make all the crucial calls in big games and manage games under pressure like he's had to right away. It's pretty obvious. Some guys are ready for it, some aren't. Kirby Smart was not ready for all that pressure in big games, making those game management calls. We see it in the NFL every week. College football, it boggles my mind in college football every Saturday when you watch coaches screw up basic calls. We're sitting at home on a couch or in a sports book saying, how could they do this? How about Sunday? Sean Payton not even forcing the Bears to use their timeouts at the end of overtime, just sending the kicker out on first down. If he misses that kick, the Bears have time to drive down and win the game. Why didn't Sean Payton run the clock down and force the Bears to use their timeouts? I mean, even guys like Sean Payton make game management mistakes. I mean, it's incredible, and we all complain about it either on our shows or on Twitter. But it's It's something that Kirby Smart struggled with. So I think he's a very good coach, excellent defensive coach. I'd like to see Georgia get more progressive offensively, or aggressive, whatever you want to call it. Georgia's just been one of those teams that never really opens it up offensively and rely more on more on their defense to win games. And I think that's something that Nick Saban's been smart enough to do and change Alabama's philosophy here in the past 5 years. Anyway, I think Kirby Smart's a pretty good coach. He's not a great coach.
Yeah, no, interesting. Okay, now let's get to the Pac-12. It's just so fascinating that we're so late in the calendar now. The Pac-12 is beginning.
Sure.
But USC and Oregon are the co-favorites at plus 220, if I remember correctly. SC's opening up at home with ASU. Laying, let's call it 11 is the consensus line. There's some 10.5. Obviously, we love Herm Edwards at ESPN. He had the cubicle next to me. I got to pick his brain a lot. I love the guy. He's injected some optimism down there in Tempe. But it's a big ask. I mean, you and I are not Clay Helton fans. We've certainly made that clear on this podcast. But we are Graham Harrell fans, and we are Slovis fans. So sure. I like this Trojans team. I'm excited as a USC fan. But this is 11 points. Where do you stand here?
Yeah, I was just talking about Kirby Smart in Georgia, Doug. How about if he hired a guy like Graham Harrell as his offensive coordinator with that Georgia defense? I'm not sure how that would work out, but it would be interesting to see if you teamed that type of Georgia defense with a guy who calls plays as an OC like Graham Harrell, what you would have. This is the rarest of games. How many times has somebody told you, wake up early for this Pac-12 game? That's going to be the case Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific time in Los Angeles. You got to be kidding me. I don't think this is the smartest move by the Pac-12. I know they want more national attention as a conference. And Larry Scott, who's not the sharpest commissioner out there, said, you know, he wants that score on the bottom line all day. He wants the Pac-12 highlights to play on all the highlight shows all day. Okay, I get it. But how big would this game be if you made it the evening showcase, maybe at 7 o'clock after Clemson Notre Dame? Still, whatever, I'll be up watching it, and it's gonna get a lot of betting action. Not as much as it would have got if it was an evening game, but again, top two quarterbacks in the Pac-12, I believe, Jaden Daniels and Keaton Slovis. Really no more excuses for Clay Helton, because this USC team is loaded on both sides of the ball. And I think that, you know, if you give Clay Helton credit for something, it's, you know, being smart enough to hire guys like Cliff Kingsbury and Graham Harrell and realize that he had to do something to upgrade that offense if he was going to, you know, elevate USC to a Pac-12 champion and a playoff contender. I picked USC to win the Pac-12 this year. And when I did my Pac-12 preview and power rated the teams, I had Arizona State number 3. And so I think this could be a really competitive game. Keaton Slovis last year, he was an afterthought. We just talked about JT Daniels at Georgia. Keaton Slovis was kind of a ho-hum recruit. Not much hype, you know, from when he got to USC. He steps in last year, completes 72%, 3,500 yards, 30 touchdowns. And now he comes back as the most hyped quarterback in the conference because you lost a lot. You lose guys like Justin Herbert and Jacob Eason, and now Keaton Slovis and Jaden Daniels are going to be the top two guys. USC has 17 starters back, okay? This is the fifth year for Helton. I'd say this is at least the second straight year he's been on the hot seat. He's 13-12 straight up, 10-15 against the spread the past 2 years. Like I said, this team is loaded. Graham Harrell, he schemes a wide-open offense. They got a lot of speed to work with. They're going to try to snap the ball quickly, run a lot of plays. I think it's going to be a fun team to watch. I think the Sun Devils are going to be a little bit more deliberate. Herm Edwards probably not going to want to get into track meet in this game necessarily. Jaden Daniels, 17 TD passes, 2 interceptions last year as a freshman for Arizona State. So he does not turn the ball over. But again, this is not the Arizona State offense of a year ago with Brandon Ayuk and Eno Benjamin. Those guys are in the NFL. Herm Edwards has had a lot of recruiting success, and he's rebuilt this offensive line. He's brought in a lot more talent than people think, and that's why I've got Arizona State power rated number 3 in the Pac-12. They might not be ready for USC in the first game, you know, with this young a team on the road. But again, you're going on the road to an empty Coliseum. So I'm not looking at road games kind of a, you know, in the same intimidating way as you did in the past. A young team going to an empty Coliseum is not that big a deal. Edwards promoted Antonio Pierce and Marvin Lewis to co-defensive coordinators. And I think this number is just a little bit too high. I made the number 8, 8.5. I had it right in that range. And I grabbed 11.5 with Arizona State. You can still grab 11 out there, I think, at plenty of spots. And, Doug, I would like to say over the total, because I think this got a chance to be a really up and down, high-scoring game. But the fact it starts at 9 a.m., I don't like that. I don't like betting over high totals that early in the morning. I just sometimes I think guys, especially on the West Coast, they might be a little sleepy when this game starts. Your body clock's not used to going at high speed that early in the morning. And maybe that's just because I'm not a morning person. But I think there are a lot of players like that too. So if this game gets off to a slow start, that might make it tough to get over that high total. If this game were in the evening, I think this would be over the total would be one of my better bets, but I'm going to stay away from the total. And I just took 11. I'd say take 11.5 with Arizona State.
Yeah. 9 a.m. out here. I mean, you got to imagine players are getting up at like 5:30 for it. Now, if they practice all week, that's the big thing, you know, not that my Brown water polo career translates too much to Pac-12 football, but I think it's the kind of thing where if you practice at that time, you're going to be much better. We always made a point of trying to train and practice the week of games at that certain time, if they were late or night games and things like that. We did it in high school, actually, too. I just think when you're that young, if you're used to getting up, I think you're okay. But you're right. Like, you can't feed off the energy and like your normal body clock. But
well, that's another thing. I'm glad you said that. That was another point I wanted to make is that early in the morning, the players, you know, typically would draw energy from the crowd, right? The crowd's fired up and that's going to wake you up and then get the adrenaline flowing. This is going to be an empty Coliseum at 9 a.m. in the morning, and that doesn't help either.
Right, and that's why situational handicapping is so important, because, you know, we talk about flat spots and things like that. Like, it can be even more pronounced without the crowd, I think. And I've noticed this year in all sports, you know, even in the NBA bubble with the Lakers, after they clinched the one seed, they were just completely bet against the next couple. I mean, yeah, they were like, I think they were catching 3.5 against the Thunder. Someone told me what the line was, and I just assumed it was OKC minus 3.5 instead of the Lakers, because I didn't think like LeBron was going to play more than 15 minutes. You know, I think it was one of those things, and then Lakers got blown out. But it's funny you mentioned Daniels, because he was like Gatorade Player of the Year, went to Modern Day, which is like the program. It's where Matt Barkley went, actually, and they won every game by double digits, total stud. But, you know, every system's different. And just if you have a dominant program and you play the high profile quarterback, doesn't necessarily mean you're the best player and the best quarterback just because, you know, you're a product of the machine, so to speak. So Daniels, it's going to be interesting to see what he had. But you're right. He got all the hype, Slovis. But he had all the production under Graham Harrell. So that's obviously.
Doug, we've also seen a lot of overhyped prep quarterbacks in Southern California over the years. How many Heismans was Jimmy Clausen supposed to win?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay. And he was a total bust in college or the pros too. So I can see that. And also just speaking to your plus 11 and reluctance, I think Clay Helton's just a conservative coach. Like, he's going to punt more than he's going to go for it. And so while Graham Harrell will throw it around and, you know, do stuff like that, I just think if you're up, you know, if one of those situations you're up 10 and you could go, and he's going to punt and things like that. So that may help your plus 11. You mentioned they're 1-3 in your power ratings in the conference. I'm assuming Oregon's number two.
I've got Oregon number two, but it's, I got to tell you, I wouldn't be surprised if Oregon falls a little bit. I've got Oregon two based on all the recruiting successes teams have, but you've had a lot of opt-outs. You lost, obviously, Justin Herbert and a lot more from last year's team. And Mario Cristobal is another one of those guys. He's kind of a knucklehead when it comes to game management. So that kind of leads us to the next game, Doug, is I've got Cal minus one over Washington as a play in the Pac-12 this week. Justin Wilcox, one of the best defensive coaches in the country.
Love him. Just love him. I love him.
Wilcox is great. He returns 18 starters. Last couple years, beat Washington as a double-digit dog. He's got one of the best quarterbacks. I just talked about Jaden Daniels and Keaton Slovis. Chase Garber is not far behind. Garbers is going to, I think, surprise people how well he plays, because we've seen poor quarterback play at Cal for a few years now. These have been some pretty bad offenses, but Garbers, I think, is going to be one of the better quarterbacks in the conference. And the fact that Washington has to replace Jacob Eason, top running back, top two wide receivers, Jimmy Lake, it's his first, you know, first game as a head coach on the road against Wilcox. I give Wilcox and Garbers the edge here, and I like Cal minus one. And when I said, when I said I had Oregon power rated number two, it's not going to surprise me one bit if Cal wins the North.
No, not at all. And it's funny you mention Oregon game management, you know, just jumping around back and forth between the two games. This was the game where Oregon could have run out the clock a couple years ago. Yes. It was Stanford in town, and then he didn't take the knee, and they fumbled, and then Stanford goes down and scored. And just like nonsense. But I'm with you on Garbers. Look, I was big on them. I think you and I were on opposite sides last year of the ASU game. I want to say it was a Friday night. And Garbers gets hurt in that game, and they just – Cal just shot themselves in the foot. The backup quarterback couldn't do anything. I think it was the UCLA transfer. And they were just so limited. Now, look, their defensive team, the over-under of this game is 43, which is just insane in 2020 college football. But that's how they are. But Garbers is legit, and Justin Wilcox's great. You feel more comfortable going to the window and firing on Cal when you know that Wilcox is involved, when you know Garber's involved. Are you going to win every bet? Of course not. But I'm with you with Cal too. I get biased and I get a little confirmation bias. I look for reasons to back people I like betting on, but sometimes that's what it takes in this game, this nonsense that we've chosen to participate in.
Now that, you know, it's, I guess Washington's a little bit of a mystery to me at this point. I've talked about everything the Huskies lost, and you have a new coach, and I'm not exactly sure what type of Huskies team we're going to see. If Washington wins this game, that's a really, really impressive win with a new quarterback on the road against Justin Wilcox with 18 starters back. I'll take my chances with Cal here. Like I said, I'm not going to be surprised if Cal ends up being the best team in the North and not Oregon. So that's something to watch in the Pac-12. I think the Arizona State-USC game is going to tell us a lot, because I really believe, and I hate to say this because what you and I have talked about with Clay Helton in the past, and he's 13-12 the past 2 years. This USC team has got so much talent. This could be the contender for the fourth playoff spot if Clay Helton doesn't screw it up. I really think USC, you know, if every game gets in, if the Pac-12 teams don't play enough games, you forget about it. They're not going to have the resume that's going to be strong enough. But USC's got the talent. And the way the schedule sets up, I think USC is going to have a pretty good case to be the fourth playoff team behind, let's just call it what it is right now. It's going to be Clemson, Alabama, Ohio State, and then a fourth team. And then USC's got a chance to be that fourth team out of the Pac-12. And I really believe that. So, because if you look at this team on paper and the fact you got a good quarterback returning, I would not write off USC this year as an elite team. I think that's got a chance to happen.
It was like we planned this out. I saved the Pac-12 for the end because I wanted to tag it with the discussion with the Big 12 being so weak like it has been. I wanted to say, do they have a chance to produce a team to go to the playoff? Because USC is 80 to 1 now to win it all. And the other team I was eyeing was Oregon, and they've gone up. I've been actually watching them for like 3-4 weeks. They've gone up from 30-1 to 40-1 to 50-1, now 60-1.
Yeah, you have one crossover game, and the Pac-12 set up USC with like the easiest crossover game possible. I think it's a home game against Washington State. That's the crossover game. So USC's road games are at Arizona, Utah, and UCLA. Home games against Arizona State, Colorado, and Washington State.
So in this case, they would face off in the Pac-12 title game. And I think that would do the trick to go to the playoff, because I don't think the Big 12 can get there. I mean, I guess Okie State could have one loss, Big whatever. 12, but
Big 12, yeah. Don't even discuss it.
Now, the question is, you know, remember a couple of years ago, Washington went and they were double-digit dogs to Alabama. So you would think the Pac-12 team would be the 4 seed. So is it even value to play? I mean, you could play out of 80-1. I mean, you know, but 40-1, you may not be able to play out of, to be honest, if you're Oregon. So you wonder, if there's value even at 40-1 with the Ducks, I think there would be value at 80-1 right now with USC.
Yeah, I think that's probably worth a shot because you look at the schedule, USC is going to be 6-0, should be 6-0 going to the Pac-12 championship game. And I think you're going to have a case for USC to be that fourth team. So I would not be critical of that bet at all. I talked about a couple of weeks ago, I bet Purdue at 200-1 to win the Big Ten championship. And the reason I did that is, you know, there's a chance for chaos in all these conferences, you know, and games canceled. And you never know how the dominoes are going to fall and which teams it's going to affect. And at first I thought, well, I'm screwed on this bet because Rondale Moore is not going to play. Jeff Brohm has got the COVID. So things were not off to a promising start. But, you know, when you look at the top of the Big Ten West with Wisconsin and Minnesota, I really didn't think those teams were that great. I thought they were vulnerable. And Purdue had a potentially explosive offense. I like Northwestern a lot, too. And I said Northwestern was at 100-1 and Purdue was at 200-1. And Purdue has a home game against Northwestern. So I bet Purdue at 200-1 saying that, you know, if they get to the Big Ten championship game against Ohio State, I got a lot of things I can do with that 200-1 ticket, right? So I went ahead and played that one instead. I think 80-1 at USC, you could do something with that too. So that's probably not a bad bet. The schedule sets up perfectly. This team is loaded, like I said. Now you just need Clay Helton not to screw it up because I think USC's got a path to the college football playoff.
That's a good bet on Purdue, by the way. I mean, look what happened with Clemson, right? Their star quarterback has COVID. They almost lose to BC at home. I mean, things like that can happen to Ohio State, just like they're happening to Wisconsin. Now, I don't want to put their quarterback on the same level as Trevor Lawrence and Justin Fields, but you get the idea. The chaos is the operative term here. So it's just funny. I was talking about it with someone, the Oregon thing, and he's like, it's 30-1, and the next week it's 40-1. They could say it's 50-1. I'm like, what the hell? This week it was 60-1. So we've been kind of eyeing it as the Big 12 keeps shooting itself in the foot. Like after the first loss, we started thinking. And the thing to remember with the college football playoff, and this is for every year, not just this year, but this is an agreement between the five Power Five commissioners, okay? That's why you can't just have like three SEC teams every year because it's not first of all, it's not the NCAA, and it's an agreement between the Power Five league, or I shouldn't say commissioners, between the Power Five leagues. So that's why if there's a chance for an undefeated, like I think a couple years ago, Wisconsin, we didn't think was very good. And they're like, they go undefeated and beat Ohio. They don't even belong. They haven't played anyone. It's like it's an agreement with the conferences. They're going to have to allow the other teams undefeated champ. It's just the nature of college football. Now this year, obviously a shorter schedule, but it'd be hard pressed to like turn down a USC or Oregon that just beat, you know, another good team that is maybe undefeated in a conference championship game and not give them a bid, especially when there's such disarray with the other conferences. So that's why it's tough for the group of five, because it's an agreement between the Power Fives. And then also that's why you think the Power Fives will get the benefit of the doubt. So I agree the Pac-12 will go if these guys get all their games and run the table.
It's an interesting thing to talk about because, excuse me, somebody asked me a couple days ago about betting Cincinnati to win the college football playoff. I said, it's really tough to do that because I can't see a team outside the Power Five getting into the playoff just the way this whole business thing is structured. It's kind of set up to exclude teams like Cincinnati. I love the Bearcats. Luke Fickell's been phenomenal. And I think you can make a strong case that Cincinnati is probably going to, might deserve a spot in the playoffs.
Yeah.
You would look at Cincinnati's schedule and resume and say, who did the Bearcats play? And then, you know, it could come down to a second team from the SEC getting in or Cincinnati. The SEC team's going to get in. You know, it's just – or a second team from the ACC. Maybe it's Notre Dame. Who knows? It's so tough to make those futures bets in college football on teams outside the Power Five because they just can't get there. You know, this is not college basketball where you can bet Dayton at 200-1 to win the whole thing, and Dayton ends up as the number one seed. You know, it's college football is a totally different setup, and I don't even mess around much with college football futures because of that. You just don't see teams outside the favorites actually get there. But that USC bet you talked about, I think that's one thing that is worth some consideration.
Well, and I think sports radio can get nauseating at times, and I think you're someone who subscribes to that philosophy. I mean, talking about like Cincinnati now in sports radio is just nonsense. Like I remember – I don't know what it was, 4 or 5 years ago when Romo got hurt and then Dak Prescott's rookie year, and he was great. And Romo wasn't expected back for like 5 more weeks. And people were making it like a hot topic. Like, what should the Cowboys do when Romo comes back? It's like, we're 5 weeks away. You know, this guy could stink over the next 3 weeks. Like, I know it's the Cowboys and I know it's Romo and I know that moves the needle, but it's exhausting. But if you want to look at it through the filter futures bets, now it's a present day conversation, right? Like, now it's interesting because the Bearcats currently are 50-1. Now, my thing is, I don't know if you can, that's even value, because if they get matched up with Clemson and they're double digit, they're 13 point dogs. Like, is that even value? Like, I don't know what they'd be, you know, they'd be probably 20-25-1 going into the playoff, right? Something silly like that. If you roll over the money lines. Now, obviously you have to project the championship game money line after beating Clemson, because then the power rating with Cincy would obviously go way up and they'd be like, oh, they're legit. So there's a little bit of projecting and math involved, but no, you're absolutely right. But futures that you said about Purdue to win the Big Ten, now that's a different story. But if there was a year it would happen in terms of it being like Cincinnati or Group of Five, this could be the year. I mean, Pac-12 could all be, you know, have cannibalization just like the Big 12. So maybe, but to your point, it is really tough because it's not an NCAA thing. It is a conference thing with the Power Fives.
I mean, who knows what's going to happen? You could have some COVID situations before the college football playoff, the week before.
Nick Saban just had it. I mean, we've had Trevor Lawrence, Nick Saban, Wisconsin quarterback who's all, you know, setting the world on fire, and it's just been crazy.
You had the top quarterback and top coach in the sport have been impacted by this. Saban's case was a false positive, I guess, but still, I mean, you've had Ohio State hasn't been, I don't think Ohio State's really been impacted by this yet. You just don't know what could happen. And that's why you can bet on some long shots, because the COVID chaos is very unpredictable. Hey, I'm glad you mentioned Tony Romo. I wanted to mention this because Maction starts tonight. A lot of people are fired up about that. And I'm fired up about Maction too, because last night we had no games in the sports world. Obviously the election took center stage, but tonight it's back to Maction, and Tony Romo was out of Eastern Illinois and he was undrafted. And I've called Cooper Rush a poor man's Tony Romo for a few years. Watch him play in the preseason. I thought that, you know, he's not Tony Romo, but he's a guy who can make some plays and he's a decent quarterback. And I thought the Cowboys made a mistake by not keeping him on. And, you know, when you watch Ben DiNucci play Sunday night, it really makes you realize what a buffoon Mike McCarthy is. Because the Cowboys let Cooper Rush go. Now they bring him back. And Cooper Rush is in a competition with Garrett Gilbert to start against the Steelers. Ben DiNucci had no business starting an NFL game last week. He should not have been the Cowboys' third quarterback. It should have been Cooper Rush or Garrett Gilbert or somebody like that before Ben DiNucci. But Mike McCarthy is not a very sharp guy. You probably read that story a couple of years ago, why Aaron Rodgers was frustrated in those walkthroughs. You know, in the late years with the Packers, they'd look around and McCarthy was not there, and they found out he was up in his office giving him a massage. You know, it's he had a massage therapist that would come up to his office, and he wouldn't be there for the run-throughs the day before the game. And there's a lot of things that irritated Aaron Rodgers. You realize how lazy McCarthy is, and he's not that sharp. How do you throw Ben DiNucci out there against the Eagles on Sunday Night Football when there are so many other better quarterback candidates? And you could say, well, with the COVID situation, it takes more than a week to get these players into the facility and the camp. You can't get them. Why was he even on the roster? He's terrible. And Cooper Rush, Garrett Gilbert are better quarterbacks. They should have been on the roster, not Ben DiNucci. So that's a totally different subject, but that reminded me of that because Cooper Rush played at Central Michigan. And, you know, you'll see under the radar guys like this in Maction, and that's part of what I like about it.
It's funny you mentioned that. So we have for Daily Wager, we have a Google Doc share overnight because all of us, different time zones and, you know, people like that, you know, Bear and Steve are on the East Coast. So sometimes we'll do an overnight thing. Then we have like a morning Zoom, but it's just to kind of get our thoughts going and what the topics the producers are thinking. And then, you know, for Cowboys Steelers, we're going to look ahead to the weekend, big picture Cowboys. And I write verbatim, I'm reading it from the Google Doc. I've already written this. I think the Cowboys are done if DiNucci is playing. The guy couldn't feel a pass rush. I realize some think this might be a flat spot for Pittsburgh, but I also think the same can be said for Dallas. They went all in on that game. I was actually impressed with their effort. I think Pitt rolls them from here, but if these Cooper Rush reports are accurate, I can see them being much more competitive with Rush, and I would pass on the game. But I like Pitt with DiNucci starting. Yeah, I know what I'm getting with DiNucci, and it's a guy who's, you know, obviously does not belong at all. He's probably the worst quarterback I've ever seen in the NFL. I'm serious. Like, in a regular season game, it's probably the worst quarterback play I've ever seen. So I want no part of it. I think the team was kind of fun with the gimmicks, and they went all in because they maybe said, hey, you know, maybe Dalton will get back. Let's try to win this game in Philly. We can actually win this division with, like, 6 wins. But, yeah, I think Cooper Rush is good, man. I think he's pretty competent. Like, I'm not going to lay 13 against that guy. But I would lay it with DiNucci playing. But there is one game. Do you like – are you on any games tonight?
I'm on Boston.
I lean NIU.
Okay.
And then I'm – where are my plays? I like Ohio with Armani Rogers transferring there.
Right. Yeah, I'm not a big Armani Rogers guy, but in the MAC, he should be able to
do something. There you go. That's my point.
I think that's he's got – that'll be interesting to watch. That's why I'm actually kind of fired up about the MAC tonight. I did play Ball State +2. A lot of sharp handicappers are on that. I think Ball State's got a chance to be the second best team in the MAC behind Buffalo. But that's all I played tonight. That Buffalo line's up to 14 now. I think I think it was as low as like 10, wasn't it? A day or a day and a half.
Yeah, ago. That rings a bell. That rings. Yeah, the NIU. But they have a lot of young guys playing now. It's come out. All the young guys for NIU. Or excuse me. Yeah, NIU, I think, has the young guys.
Yeah, see, that line was actually – sorry, Doug. 2 days ago, that line was 10.5 at some spots. Yeah, now it's
right.
That shows you how far NIU has kind of fallen here. In the MAC, is this was the premier program in the conference. Now they're 2 touchdown home underdogs to Buffalo. So, now Ball State +2 is the only thing I played in that conference tonight, but it's going to be good to kick back and watch some action and evaluate these teams too.
What do you make of who's going to start, Rourke's younger brother or Rogers, who's obviously going to be pretty fast? Probably Rogers, right? Like, you got to think Rogers is going to play.
I would think Rogers is going to start, but I haven't read about that today, so I don't know yet.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, good stuff. It was fun to talk college football. Good to have them action. 6 games tonight, just a loaded card. Next week, I think it's going to be split up a little bit. So I kind of like the spread out. I get a little saturated on Saturdays, like I miss games. But this way, you know, with fewer conferences and all that and staggered games, I get a little bit better. I can watch all the games, literally every snap of every game. So thanks for your insight, man. I know our listeners appreciate it as well.
You bet, Doug. Thanks, man.
Kicking is for losers.
All right, welcome into another UFC portion of our podcast. This one extremely abbreviated, so let's have some fun with this. Matthew and Lou, good to have you guys on the pod. All right, let's start with the main event. Obviously, last week we had the Anderson Silva, a big name in mixed martial arts. So you guys each have a play on the over. And again, this is back in the Apex here in Las Vegas. We're no longer on Fight Island like last week was at the Apex as well. So Lou, I'll let you go first.
Okay, main event is light heavyweight, Thiago Santos, Glover Teixeira. My position is going to be on the side here. It's my opinion that though Teixeira has looked decent recently, he's 41 years old, and really he's made for Santos in that his biggest weakness as a mixed martial artist is that when he gets touched on the chin by a power striker, he goes out. And Santos is an explosive powder keg of a power striker. Now, when we reverse the field and we look at how Teixeira lands, sets up against Santos, I think if Teixeira were able to execute the perfect fight, and I think he executed it against Smith just his last fight, if he were to mask that performance and put on his best fight ever, he has a chance to get this fight into the third round perhaps, and maybe try and get the Santos, who's a very muscular, structured man, a little bit sapped of his strength, onto the floor where Glover Teixeira would have advantage. That said, I think in realistic measures, Santos goes out there, and it must be noted on Santos that his last fight was against John Bones Jones. That fight was in 2019, but he had MCL and ACL damage to both knees, had both operated on, and has been inactive since. Teixeira has won two fights since Santos has been inactive. But all that said, Santos, who will have just a 1-inch reach advantage, but a 5-year age difference, is much too powerful and explosive, and he's going to catch Teixeira. And I believe Santos is a very strong pick. I'm going to use him as one side of a parlay. His price is minus 230 or minus 240. And I think that's the way I'd go. But people that want to bet him straight out, I would not have them hesitate. And because this is a 5-round fight, you could surely reduce your exposure on Santos by going inside the distance if you chose. That's just not how I'll go on this fight.
What about if you wanted to do maybe inside the distance? What could you get that down to?
Inside the distance is still like a minus 140, minus 150. Yeah. And so when you think about all the different ways it could go for another 60 cents, I don't know that if it was 110 or close to even, I'd be all over it. But in this case, I'm going to just take a safe position on Santos to get his hand raised, and I'll team him with another fighter in an upcoming card.
Right, it's not worth a big change. What about you, Matthew?
I'm actually playing the under on this fight. You know, we're back in the smaller 25-foot octagon in the apex here in Nevada, which tends to help power strikers and tends to help elite submission grapplers because it forces that engagement. And like Lou, I like Santos here. I think that he took the time to heal the knees, obviously coming off the big injury. But when I looked at his fights before, I thought a lot of things stood out to me. Number one, his fight against Jan Blachowicz is very similar to how I expect this fight to go, as Jan Blachowicz and Glover Teixeira have very similar fighting styles. They're both actually really good on the ground and slower power punchers when standing up. And Thiago Santos absolutely dusted Jan Blachowicz. He had, knocked out Eric Anders before that. This is a guy who, coming into the John Jones fight, had three straight knockouts. And what do we know about Glover Teixeira is that he's really a slow starter. At this point in his career, it takes Glover a little bit to get going. Not surprising, considering he's 41 years old, that's the case. But we saw in the Smith fight against Anthony Lionheart Smith, he was getting it put on him in the first round. I think a lot of people expected that fight to be stopped in the first round, as Anthony Lionheart Smith landing huge shots. Same thing on the Ion Cutelaba fight. The Hulk was putting it on Glover Teixeira. And then eventually, again, Teixeira was able to get the fight to the ground, where he was able to control it in both of those fights. But in this fight, I actually think a slow start against a striker the caliber of Thiago Santos, at some point you can only play with fire so many times. You continue to have slow starts. You continue to get hurt early in the first round. At 41 years old, we know people's chins don't hold up forever. I think this could be the night where Glover Teixeira gets hurt again in that slow start early in the fight. And except this time, Thiago Santos is able to put him away, and we're getting plus money.
Interesting. So you've been riding the streak of overs, but it's not so much just like a trend better. You've appreciated the matchups, and you think that this matchup lends itself to the under, and like you said, plus money. So that's certainly enticing. Not a lot of other options that you guys have circled, so to speak. The next fight, I believe you're both on the same side. Matthew, why don't you go with this one, the next fight?
Yeah, Brendan Allen, basically a pick'em here against Ian Heinisch. And certainly a big step-up fight for Brendan Allen, but you could make a case that he's already fought tougher than Heinisch in his UFC career, including a submission win last October against the red-hot Kevin Holland. All Brendan Allen has done is win since coming into the UFC. Now 4-0, including his Dana White Contender Series fight, three of those wins by finish, including a knockout of Tom Breeze that has aged really well, a submission victory over Kevin Holland that has aged really well, considering where Holland is now, and he's still just 24 years old. The question marks about Allen were, how would this young man handle the big spotlight coming into the UFC at 22 years old? But I think the reason he's been able to handle it so well He trains at one of the best gyms in the country up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at Rufus Sport, with a bunch of great guys up there, including Anthony Pettis, Sergio Pettis, a lot of great fighters up there. Duke Rufus and the team do a great job. And Brandon Allen is one of the hottest prospects right now in MMA. But we have so many red hot young guys that I think what he's done gets overshadowed a little bit. Just looking at his resume, the fact that in the last 12 months he has finishes over Kevin Holland and Tom Breeze, he already has two wins in 2020. So you got to love the fact that the 24-year-old is staying really active. And he's 14-3 and has three losses on the regional scene as basically an 18 and 9-year-old. But all three come against guys who are now in the UFC. Trevin Giles, Eric Anders, Anthony Hernandez all beat Allen on the regional scene when he was a teenager. All three of those in the UFC, as he's starting to mature now into his mid-20s with a great camp. I think this guy could legitimately be fighting for the title by the end of 2021, early 2022. And I think he gets the job done here against Ian Heinisch, who you could make a case is only the third best guy he's fought since entering the UFC.
Just a few additions there. In this case, Brendan Allen has worked at Rufus Sports, and he still maintains a friendly relationship there. But for this fight, he went to Florida to train at Stanford MMA so that he could be matched up with a bunch of different types of large fighters and diverse strikers and mixed martial artists. One of his teammates at Rufus Sport, Mearshart, is a guy that fought Heinisch in his last fight, and Heinisch won. So there's a little bit of familiarity there as well. These two, when they were in LFA, Allen was really motivated to try and fight Heinisch, and that fight never transpired for whatever reason. Allen is 3 inches taller. He's 8 years younger. He's got a 5-inch reach advantage. All those will present him advantage standing, although the power advantage is going to go to Heinisch. Heinisch is a wrestler, and in most cases, I'll tell you that world-class wrestling is kryptonite to Brazilian jiu-jitsu specialists, which is exactly what Allen is. But in this particular case, Heinisch is not world-class wrestling, although his base is solid. As well, when I tell you about Allen going to Sanford MMA to complement himself as a fighter, Heinisch, this is his fourth camp in four fights. He went from Factory X now to Genesis. He's coming off a knee injury. He's been spending some time at Extreme Couture. When a fighter's nomadic with camps, it's a red flag. And while this is a closely lined fight today, the opener was Brandon Allen minus 160. So I'm going to dispute and disagree with the flow of money to Heinisch. And I'm going to jump Allen at close to a pick-up price because I think that he has great advantage in his fight arsenal. And if this fight does hit the ground, it'll be fascinating to see if Heinisch can maintain top control or if Allen can quickly reverse, scramble, get up, or take his back.
Matthew, any comment on that, even though I know you guys are on the same side?
Yeah, you know, Lou talked about, you know, the BJJ game of Brandon Allen, and it was on full display in his last fight against Dawkus, a fight where he was using his stand-up. He actually didn't have to use his ground game. Brandon Allen easily won the first two rounds. And in round three, Dawkus not only got him down, but immediately got his back with, you know, over 4 minutes left in the round. And Brandon Allen had to, as a very young fighter, again, had to fight off a situation where probably 7 out of 10 guys at least get rear naked choked there. And he literally fought it off for 3 full minutes in a terrible situation where, again, I think most guys get rear naked choked. He was able to defend the entire time, stay calm, ending up reversing the situation at the end of the round. And then he was the guy landing the big strikes to finish the fight. I'm just so impressed with the development of this young man, the level of competition that he fought at 17 and 18 years old. These are ranked guys in the UFC now. I mean, Trevin Giles is on this card fighting down below. Suddenly already, this is a guy in Brendan Allen who I think is a superstar in the making. And one thing that Lou talked about that's really prevalent in this is, you know, the different skill sets and paths to victory. Brandon Allen can submit him. He can knock him out. He might even be able to out-wrestle him. I just think a lot of the advantages here in favor of the 24-year-old, and I really like Brandon Allen.
Love it. Love it. All right, short and sweet, and that's all we got. Right, guys? Am I missing anything?
Lou, you want to talk about the co-main? I know you had a lean.
Yeah, no, that's basically all we have, and I'm not a big chalk player, but listen, 41-year-old Andre Arlovsky is statuesque, but he's tougher than John Wayne Saddle, and he's very stubborn. The fighter he's going to go against, Bozer, is a Canadian who's 12 years younger, 2 inches shorter, and is going to have a 2-inch reach disadvantage. However, he has a granite beard. He being undersized, he weighed 240 for his last fight, has really excellent legwork. And his speed, his precision striking, and his granite beard are going to be way too much for Arlovsky. But Bozer will win this fight. I'm not sure how, but I will give Arlovsky the durability and the toughness angle that, because this is a 3-round fight, it may go to decision. But make no mistake about it, this is Bozer's fight. To lose.
I agree with that. And I think it's always interesting with heavyweights to look at the totals, because they're almost always 1.5. You rarely see a total with heavyweights that's not 1.5. But in this fight, the total is 2.5 over minus 35. So exactly what you just talked about is what the odds maker's expectation is, that Tanner Bozer's speed is going to be too much and he's going to win a decision against Andre Arlovsky. I actually am making a little bit of a lean, and I haven't quite put a play on it yet, but I probably end up will by fight night, is the fact that Andre Arlovsky has been knocked out 11 times and is 41 years old. And Tanner Bozer is starting to get that power game going at heavyweight. 2 straight knockout wins for Tanner Bozer. If you give me under 2.5 at plus money, the temptation's probably going to be too great for me by fight night, and I'll probably end up on the under.
Awesome. Love that. All right, guys. Love that. Short and sweet, and we'll get you back here next week.
Thanks, guys. Best of luck this weekend. Take care.
All right, you too.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks, Matthew.
Sounds to me like you guys a couple of bookies.
All right, that's going to do it for this podcast. Thanks to Matthew and Lou, and also to Matt Humans. A lot of good stuff across the board for both UFC and college football. Tomorrow, Mr. Executive Director, big move by John Murray in the Baby Bankroll Bonanza. I went 0-2. The Prince of Props chimes in with 2-0 run. And look at that. We have, it's all back to a race, the home stretch, basically the halfway point of the regular season, I should say. So Murray and I will break down the card, react to some kicking us for loser moments. And thanks to everyone to downloading and rating and reviewing and all that good stuff. And we'll catch you back here tomorrow.